This is The Rounds Table. All right, welcome back, Rounds Table listeners. A very exciting episode for you in store today. Dr. Leah Karyannopoulos is joining us again, and we're going to be discussing a couple of articles, both of which I think will be relevant to the internist as well as the intensivist. Leah, what article is up first?
All right. So the first one we've got on the docket is called Effect of Non-Invasive Airway Management of Comatose Patients with Acute Poisoning, a Randomized Clinical Trial. This was published by Freund et al. In JAMA at the end of November of this year.
Yes, so this will be relevant to the internist. I can think of many patients who I'm referred with suspected overdose. However, you know, GCS lesson 8, intubate. So maybe I won't be seeing these patients. But anyway, what was the research question?
So the question here was, in patients with suspected poisoning and a GCS below 9, like you just referenced, is withholding intubation superior to usual care?
All right. And why did this article catch your eye?
I mean, I could wax poetic about this article forever. I love it, if nothing else, as an exercise in challenging dogma and asking, like, why do we do what we do? Do we have support for what we do? And how do we develop evidence to answer those questions? So if nothing else, I'm like so jealous that I wasn't the one to think of this study because it's just so cool. But specifically for the question they're asking. So we all know, internists, intensivists, everyone alike knows that decreased LOC has historically been a concern for risk of aspiration. And so when patients aspirate, that can lead to complications like respiratory distress, pneumonitis, pneumonia, and ingestions like alcohol or other drugs or medications are a common non-traumatic cause of decreased LOC that are often associated with high rates of intubation itself. And we intubate patients in the hopes of avoiding things like aspiration and its complications. But the funny thing is that intubation itself carries many risks, among which aspiration and circulatory collapse are probably the biggest primary concerns. So funny enough, the thing that we're doing to avoid complications also carries with it the same risks as a trade-off. And historically, the GCS score has been used to kind of guide. We've all heard the age-old GCS 8 intubate. But what's funny is the GCS score was originally designed for trauma patients and used as a predictor of mortality and to give guidance there, and then kind of metastasized over into other populations. We see it used in the ICU as a way of reporting sort of level of sedation, even though we have other tools, but it's easy because it's a common language. And again, I hear it all the time when residents and learners go to assess a patient and kind of they use the GCS as a means of communicating what they're doing. And what's interesting, though, is that, again, that guidance of the GCS of 8 to intubate was for trauma patients, and it's kind of made its way over to other populations, but it might not actually apply here. Mm-hmm. And in fact, prior smaller studies haven't necessarily definitively supported that early intubation always reduces the risk of aspiration or death.
Yeah, but it's the power of the rhyming GCS lesson 8 intubate. Like, oh,
it's
man.
True. It just sticks. And good luck catchy. Getting past it. Yeah.
catchy branding by the trauma
it
world.
It is. But, it is. It's well done. Right,
so what was the study design here?
So this is a multi-center open label for obvious reasons RCT that was performed in France. The population was adult patients with a clinical suspicion of acute poisoning and a decreased LOC with a GCS less than 9. And so when they say acute poisoning, it's meant to be anything like ingestion related. The important thing being that it was for patients that came in with poisonings, so to speak, that are not easily reversed. So a patient that came in with just opioid overdose, for example, that could be quickly reversed with naloxone, wouldn't have been included in this study because you have a treatment that can prevent intubation entirely, so it's not as relevant. The intervention here was intubation being withheld unless a very specific set of emergency intubation criteria were met. So things like seizure, respiratory distress, which is defined by an oxygen saturation less than 90 that persisted after application of nasal prongs, vomiting, and then shock defined by systolic blood pressure less than 90 after 1 liter of crystalloid. Our comparator was that the decision to intubate was left at the discretion of the treating physician. So it's not that they were required to intubate the patient regardless, but it was left to their clinical discretion as opposed to needing to meet these criteria. The intervention period was till the first of 4 hours or the patient recovering their GCS. And in the meantime, the patient was closely monitored by a nurse or MD with continuous vital monitoring and monitoring of their GCS. And then after 4 hours, if the patient had woken up, fantastic. If they hadn't, they were managed according to routine practice. Some important exclusions. I've already mentioned the suspicion of an ingestion that could be readily reversed, but also cardiotropic poisoning. So things like beta blocker overdose weren't included here. Pregnancy, because we know those patients have a higher risk of aspiration at baseline. And then an immediate need for intubation. So if there wasn't a discussion to be had about whether the patient needed to be intubated, you were to just go ahead. The outcome was an interesting hierarchical composite endpoint of in-hospital death, length of ICU stay, length of hospital stay. This was all truncated at 28 days.
Okay, so if I have this right, we have an open label, randomized trial. The included patients were those with an acute intoxication that couldn't be readily reversed. And essentially, they're getting randomized to let the doctor do what he or she wants for these individuals with a GCS of 8 or below, or they get randomized to, no, we want you to follow these specific criteria for when to intubate. And the outcome was a somewhat complex composite of length of stay, mortality, and other stuff. Do I kind of have that right?
You got it. You got it absolutely right.
All right. So what did the included patients look like?
Yeah, so they had 237 patients randomized, 225 that were ultimately analyzed. And that's in large part because obviously with the presentation of these patients, you can't get a priori consent. So there are a few patients that after enrollment and randomization, once they woke up and regained capacity, did not give consent for their information and data to continue to be collected. But for the patients that were analyzed, the age was 33 to 34 on average. 60 to 64% of our patients were men. Approximately 60% of the patients included were captured in the emergency department. Interestingly, 37% were pre-hospital. So they did an amazing job of getting paramedics and pre-hospital care providers involved in this study. And only one patient in the entire study was actually included in ICU. And I mean, what's interesting here is it kind of makes sense, right? Like you've kind of pointed out from the IM point of view, even from the ICU point of view, these decisions are usually getting made even before we get to these patients. That's not to say that there aren't patients on the ward that this happens to and that have misadventures despite being in hospital. But in this case, it was kind of pre all of this. And then the primary toxin for most patients was alcohol in about 65%. And then benzos were the other most common for 40%. The median GCS here was 6. So truly met our criteria of, you know, less than 9. And should we be worried about intubating?
Yeah, and this sort of resonates with the patient population that I typically see when I'm getting that referral for intoxication or overdose, typically a man who is young. I am over the median age of included participants. So this is a very young patient population, okay?
Yeah.
Pediatric by GIM standards.
But honestly, it feels that way by ICU standards.
So what did they find? Did this intervention work or not so much?
Yeah. So interestingly, I think unexpectedly to the authors, there were 0 deaths in either arm. But compared to routine care, their intervention resulted in a lower median length of ICU stay. So 0 hours versus 24 hours. So the relative risk of 0.39. So your confidence interval is from 0.24 to 0.66. So very much less. A median length of hospital stay of 21.5 hours versus 37. So your point estimate there is 0.74 and your confidence interval is 0.53 to 1.03. And then they did this really interesting thing called the win ratio to look at the composite outcome. And I'll explain what it is, but what they found for their primary outcome was a composite for their, what they found for their primary composite was a win ratio of 1.85. So the confidence interval is 1.33 to 2.58. And so what the win ratio is it's this new to me, at least, approach to handling composite outcomes. The reason being that one of the big concerns with composites is that you have this hierarchy, meaning that you try your best to group together outcomes that are of similar patient importance and you expect to move in similar directions, but you're not always going to get that right. And if you look at the primary composite here, I as a patient probably care more about whether I die versus if I spend one more day in hospital. And so if you say to me, I can give you this intervention that's going to, for the patients it works for, it will save you one day in hospital, but you are 10 times more likely to die, I'll probably go, yeah, not interested. And so what the win ratio attempts to do is factor in this hierarchy of importance of outcomes. And so recognizing that I'm not a statistician, but I'll do my best here. Essentially what it does is it takes pairs of matched patients from the intervention and the control group, and you start to compare them one-to-one. And so you start with your most important outcome. So in this case, death. And you go, okay, so for each matched pair in the intervention versus the control group, in this pair, did the intervention patient die? Did the control patient die? And whoever didn't die, so to speak, gets scored as a win on that outcome. From there, and you're tallying the total number of wins over the number of losses. So that's why there isn't like a unit associated with this, because it's just a division of numbers without a unit. From there, you move on to the next most important. So for those that don't die, you move on to, okay, length of ICU stay. And again, you compare your matched pairs and go, okay, who had the shorter length of ICU stay? And for each one, that gets assigned as a win in each group. And so you continue going onwards through each piece of your composite. And then you just take the total number of wins over the total number of losses. And the idea there is that you don't stop counting the moment they just hit the first piece of the composite. Because if a patient, again, gets extubated sooner but then dies, you kind of lose out on that hierarchy if you just kind of compare it as the first moment that they meet one of the composite endpoints.
Yeah, a great summary on the win ratio. And I Googled this, I cheated. But yeah, win ratio is pretty new. I guess, especially by like statistical standards, it looks like it's been around for maybe a decade. And I've only seen it in one other trial related to my favorite class of drugs, SGLT2s. But I'm going off on a tangent, so I'll get back to the script. What were the main limitations? Clearly, you won't say the statistical analysis was a limitation.
Yeah, no, I mean, I love it. I'm sure that like statisticians far above my pay grade could wax on about the strengths and weaknesses of this, but I won't even begin to attempt that. So from my point of view, I'd say one of the main limitations is that this could be tough to generalize. I mean, it's very resource intensive to sit and monitor patients for 4 hours straight, especially because, sure, you can have them on continuous monitors for vitals, although there are hospitals where even that can be tough. But you also need people that can be able to go in and kind of assess them and make sure that they're not vomiting. And the moment they do vomit, intervene and kind of pay attention there. So that could be tough from sort of an implementation point of view. And then in this study specifically, like we said, a good percentage of the population was actually from pre-hospital. And so you need to get buy-in from them and sort of disseminate that information, which isn't maybe so much a limitation as it is a challenge from a practical point of view. The fact that there were no deaths is a great thing, but again, makes it tough because you're looking at endpoints that are, as we've said, a little bit lower down on the hierarchy of patient importance. And then I think that the most important thing here is that there's this high risk of now going in the opposite direction. So we've already talked about how the GCS came from the trauma population and has migrated its way over. And I think that the enthusiasm for a study like this certainly puts us at risk of people doing the opposite and going, oh, well, I saw this one study that you don't have to intubate with a GCS less than 9. And so it applies to anyone and everyone. And so having that inappropriate influence on a different population is certainly a risk, I suppose.
Yeah, I find practice changes so slowly. Mm-hmm. I am a little bit less worried about that, but you're right. It's time for a new slogan. I don't know, maybe like GCS lesson 8, hesitate. GCS lesson 8, educate, that you don't need to debate them right away. I don't know. I don't know if you have a better idea.
I was trying to think of a clever rhyming slogan, and I came up dry. I think despite the fact that I had a second attempt at this recording, I'll admit it on record that I screwed it up the first time. I haven't since come up with anything good. So
that's all right. The holidays are days away, so I really can't blame you. But so what's the take-home point for our listeners?
I think the take-home here is that, as you've kind of pointed out with your GCS 8 hesitate, the GCS less than 9 in this population doesn't mean that you necessarily need to urgently jump to intubation. It's a small study, it's early yet, but I do think that it supports that taking some time to monitor, consider the risk benefit, and think about the course you expect the patient to take, you expect the underlying mechanism to evolve with, is supported here by some pretty good data. So taking that time to think and then decide what you do.
Yeah. Last time we recorded, I can't remember what you said. One of your slogans is when you're on service, maybe like, don't just do something, stand there. Oh, this feels like another one of these.
Oh, it was, don't just stand there, do nothing. I think.
Yes. There you go. Yeah. So then is that the practice changing point that maybe we shouldn't be doing something here?
I would say so. I would say that this is starting to make me feel like, yeah, you don't need to jump right on in. And I think, again, from a more philosophical point of view, it's this really clever example of taking a look at the things we do in medicine and challenging dogma and kind of going, wait, but why? And coming up with ways to kind of really think critically about what we're doing.
Yeah, we're even at greater fault of that on the GIM ward, where mm-hmm. I feel like no one has really cared to run randomized trials on mm-hmm. said ward until maybe like the COVID era.
Yeah.
As a result, so many of the things that we do are based on really lousy evidence.
Yeah.
So I'm all for questioning dogma, and something that's very prevalent on the GIM ward are patients with these suspected penicillin allergies. Mm. And that is why this article entitled Efficacy of a Clinical Decision Rule to Enable Direct Oral Challenge in Patients with Low-Risk Pen Allergy, the PALLAS randomized trial, really caught my eye.
That's awesome. So why don't you tell us, a fantastic segue, by the way, why don't you tell us what the research question was here?
Is oral penicillin challenge non-inferior to standard of care penicillin skin testing in patients with low risk of penicillin allergy?
All right. So let me get this straight. It's essentially asking, can I come in as a non-allergist and give someone an oral challenge dose as opposed to needing to bring someone in who can do skin testing to determine whether or not someone has a penicillin allergy? Have I got that right?
Exactly.
Awesome. So why is this important? Why care?
So we know that less than 5% of patients that are labeled with a penicillin allergy are truly allergic, but that is such a sticky label, okay?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And there's been really good data and studies to demonstrate that if you carry that label, if you're the patient who it says, oh, they have an allergy to penicillin, those mm-hmm. patients have a longer length of stay, they're more likely to get broad spectrum and inappropriate antibiotics, and they have an increased risk of antibiotic resistant infections. Mm-hmm. So, you know, currently the standard of care to remove that sticky label involves specialized testing with prick and intradermal skin tests followed by an oral challenge. And this is all very labor intensive, resource intensive, mm-hmm. when most of the time, the patient doesn't even have a penicillin allergy. So that's why this really struck a chord with me, I guess.
Yeah, I'm totally sold. I mean, we see it all the time in ICU. Patients come in and it's kind of like, oh yeah, my mom told me that I had a rash when I was 6 months old, and that's why I know I have an allergy. And then at least at the site I work at, we have an allergist that you kind of write an order for penicillin testing, and I've never actually met this man. He just kind of appears at who knows what hour of the night, and a note materializes in the chart saying that, nope, they're not allergic, go ahead. But one, if he retires, I don't know what we're going to do. And two, in things like sepsis, especially in the ICU, when you don't have 12 plus hours to wait to decide on antibiotics, it becomes a real challenge.
Yep, I agree. And like probably leads to broad spectrum antibiotics.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. So this was a randomized controlled trial, open label, two arm, non-inferior mm-hmm. at 6 outpatient centers, 3 in North mm-hmm. America and 3 in Australia. Using the sort of PICO framework to think about the study, the population, these were individuals with a PENFAST score lower than 3. And this PENFAST, acronym rule has mm-hmm. previously been validated. So if your score is less than 3, there's like a 97% chance that you do not have a penicillin allergy. So what does this PENFAST thing stand for? So the PEN is penicillin, FAST. So F is 5 years or less since the reaction. So if yes, you get 2 points. Whereas if it was, oh, my mom or dad told me when I was a baby, you'd get 0 points. The A stands for anaphylaxis or angioedema, and you'd get 2 points. The S stands for severe cutaneous adverse reaction. So not like, oh, I had like really bad urticaria. It would be like, oh, like I saw a plastic surgeon because my skin was falling off or something.
Got it.
And then the T stands for treatment required for the reaction. So that's the PENFAS score. And as mentioned, they included adults with a score lower than 3. Some key exclusion criteria, prior anaphylaxis with any drug, mast cell disease, chronic spontaneous urticaria, the intervention, so direct oral challenge with penicillin, but most often it was actually like Amox that the patients would have gotten, 250 milligrams. Comparator would be that skin prick testing followed by oral challenge. And the outcome essentially was like a bad allergic reaction. That's like the non-medical way that I'll describe it. And this could have included angioedema, anaphylaxis, respiratory compromise. And it was a non-inferior analysis with a upper margin of 5% on the absolute scale.
Gotcha. And so what did the patients look like here?
642 were screened, 382 were randomized. Most had a PENFAS score of 0 or 1. Average age was 50, 65% were women, 93% were white. One-fifth had a history of asthma. And when you ask them, oh, like, when did this penicillin reaction occur? The vast majority of the time, it was during childhood, which is in keeping with what both of you and I see on the inpatient setting.
Yeah, I would say this is pretty reflective of the population we're seeing here. So what were the main results? What did they find?
So the primary outcome occurred in one patient in the intervention group and one patient in the control group. That's a risk difference of 1 - 1, 0. Okay, so there's no difference in the risk.
Got it.
With confidence intervals going from -1 to +1. They also looked at sort of more longer term outcomes by day 45. How often have they had like a bad allergic reaction? And it was 9 in the intervention group and 10 in the control group. So pretty darn similar, but if anything, certainly not higher in this intervention group. And there were no serious adverse events.
Awesome. And then what about like the long-term, okay, great, we found they're in hospital, they didn't have adverse events. What about like the documentation of the allergy label for the next time they present to hospital?
Yeah, and that is the single biggest limitation. So they don't have those long-term outcomes, which is what I would care the most about. What happens a year later when they come into hospital with a fever? Do they still have that penicillin allergy label in their chart, or did it fall off? This was also an unblinded randomized trial and a relatively small sample size, but it's just really impressive, both for your trial and my trial. These are non-industry funded trials, which are so hard to get done. And they're answering questions that like, we should have known the answer to, I don't know, like at least 50 years ago.
Like, absolutely.
Penicillin is not new. Alcohol, last I checked, is not new. And like intoxication with alcohol and other drugs isn't new. So those are some of the limitations.
Okay, got it. So what's your take home point here?
PENFAST less than 3. You know, you can give the person a dose of amoxicillin, maybe 250 milligrams. And if they have no reaction to it, guess what? You've effectively ruled out that they have a penicillin allergy.
Amazing. I mean, that'll make my life way easier. Is this practice changing for you?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I'm back on service in a few weeks. And my game plan is when I see somebody with a quote unquote pen allergy, I will Google PENFAS to remind myself of the questions I need to ask. And if their score is low, we can try them out on a MOX 250.
I love it. That's awesome.
All right, Leah. Well, that is the end of the show. By the time this gets released, it'll probably be the new year. So what good stuff do you have going into this new year?
Oh, man. I have a personal plug for something I'm excited about that maybe isn't relevant to all the listeners, but I've been working for the last year and a half plus to get a research study off the ground looking at involving family and doing mobility and physio activities for patients in the ICU. And we have finally started recruiting. And in fact, we enrolled our very first patient this week. So I'm very excited to see that kind of pet project get moving.
Oh, congrats. That's incredible. Thank you. I can think of studies that I was a part of. It's like that first patient you get recruited. You're like, oh, that feels good. So congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm very excited to see how it plays out. How about you?
Yeah, similarly, maybe not of interest to most of the listeners, but hey, it's like my show, so I'm going to talk about whatever I want. yes. So it dovetails on the non-inferiority concept and idea. I always found it quite confusing and challenging to understand. So there's links to two videos, one from Hannah Sachs at the New England Journal of Medicine Evidence, a really great, you know, 4-minute summary, and then one from my lab, everything you need to know about non-inferior analyses in 5 minutes or something like that. So awesome. Give it a listen if you want to learn more about non-inferiority studies.
I will totally be checking that out. That sounds awesome.
Yeah, especially if you're studying for your Royal College, not you, yes. but you know, the listener, because they love to ask those god-awful questions.
Oh, so my gosh, yeah.
Hopefully it'll be helpful. But all right, Leia, well, always a great fun to chat. You take care, and I guess, yeah, Happy New Year when it comes.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for having me. Always a pleasure and a privilege to get to join you.
Awesome. Take care.
The Rounds Table is hosted online at healthydebate.ca. Follow us on Twitter at Rounds Table. Thanks to our audio editors, Emilio Garcia Flores and Arjun Sharma. Also thanks to Amol Verma, founder of The Rounds Table, and Kieran Quinn, the previous director. We'd also like to give a big thanks to Seema Marwaha, editor-in-chief at Healthy Debate, for all the support.